Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times best-selling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. And today, to start the episode, we're going to have Craig put on that environmental reporter hat because his most recent article for the Florida Phoenix, floridaphoenix.com, is something that came to my awareness a couple of weeks ago. I reached out to Craig to have him explain it to me. And this, Craig is going to take us deep into the weeds here of Florida conservation.
Well, not too deep. This
is an important story, but it's complex. And even I, you know, before you explained it to me, had no idea what was going on or being talked about here. So lay this out to us at a water management district and land use and sale for dummies level.
Okay, so Florida has 5 water management districts. They're in charge of making sure our water supply continues to be plentiful and clean, and also they're supposed to protect us from flooding. And a big part of that is they buy land in the watershed so it doesn't wind up, you know, getting built over and polluting the water and polluting the aquifer and so forth. Mm-hmm. So, and a lot of the state's preserved land has wind up as part of the state park system or as county parks and so forth. The St. John's River Water Management District has been having some cash flow problems. And so they thought that one of the ways they could fix this was by making a list of some of the properties they had bought that they didn't need anymore and selling those off and using that to raise money to buy other land. Mm-hmm. And so the staff was supposed to go through and pick out which properties could be sold off. Well, they put an item about that on the consent agenda for their June 14th meeting. Consent agenda is usually the stuff that's completely non-controversial and they vote for it all at once and there's no discussion of it and they move on to the important stuff.
It's 27 different items and they just yay or nay the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's almost always yay because it's trivial.
And you know, lazy reporters, members of the public often don't look at that. Fortunately, somebody did. An Audubon, Florida official named Chris Farrell looked through the consent agenda for the meeting, looked at each item, spotted this thing and said, "Whoa, wait a minute. They're talking about getting rid of 18,000 acres of land that had been bought for conservation. Where are these properties?" Mm-hmm. And he flipped over to the backup material. There were no maps. Instead, there was a list of property numbers from the various counties. And these were like 127 parcels stretching from Jacksonville to Orlando. So he started looking up the numbers in each county's property tract space and discovered that there were some pretty big, significant properties here. There was a piece of Payne's Prairie State Preserve Park near Gainesville. There was a section of the Hal Scott Preserve near Orlando that people love. They call it an oasis in the middle of the development there. And so he started, you know, raising questions. He notified his boss, Julie Rathmill at Audubon, Florida. She started calling people. Environmental groups got upset. Counties that run these parks got upset. Everybody started bombarding the St. John's River Water Management District with questions saying, A, why are you getting rid of essential land? And B, why is it on the consent agenda where nobody pay attention to it?
Yeah.
And so to his credit, the head of the water management district, a guy named Mike Register, said, "It's all a big mistake. We're pulling it from the agenda. We're not going to vote on it. And we'll start over completely." And the question is, how did it end up there in the first place?
Yeah.
And how did it end up on the consent agenda? And there's lots of questions still swirling. They still have not explained that. Farrell told me that someone from the water management district said, "Oh, well, now that we've pulled it from the agenda, everybody can just forget it happened and not worry about it ever happening again." And he was like, no, we need to find out how this happened so we make sure it never happens.
Right. When you're talking about 18,000 acres of undeveloped land, it's dubious that even one of those would be considered non-essential, because as much development as there is, I don't care if it's an overgrown lot, just for what it can do to mitigate flooding and prevent a little bit of water runoff going into streams before it can trickle through the ground and be cleaned a little bit. You know, it's marginal if that idea should be valid for 1 acre, let alone 18,000, let alone acres that are adjacent to state parks and the like. So it's convenient for someone to say, this is just a clerical oversight. Don't worry about it. It'll never happen again. Fortunately or unfortunately, water management districts haven't earned that level of trust, nor has the state. And boy, you know, it's hard to imagine it not or being tried again if a stink isn't made over it.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, and the point I make in the column is they tried this 10 years ago. it was during the Rick Scott administration. Mm-hmm. They were going to find enough property in the state's holdings to sell off enough to raise $50 million. Well, they couldn't do it. They couldn't do it. They ended up, after 9 months of everybody yelling at them, mm-hmm. stopping the whole thing. The two people in charge of digging through the property records resigned. They were like, we can't do this anymore. And the DEP dropped the whole thing because they couldn't do it. There was nothing that was non-essential.
Yeah. Yeah. Great column from Craig, FloridaPhoenix.com. Some really insightful reporting there and a little bit into, you know, how the sausage is made. And also, mm-hmm. we've done this before. I won't get into it again. The Rick Scott ideas about essentially turning the state parks into amusement parks and golf courses and selling them off. It's a great reminder to anyone who's going to be voting for or against Rick Scott at any level in the future, what a dangerous, dangerous individual he is for anyone who loves the planet.
I mentioned that his time in office I refer to as the Mad Slasher years because mm-hmm. he and his appointees treated Florida's environmental programs the way, you know, a Mad Slasher would treat a bunch of teenagers in the movies.
Yeah, so. Just the worst. FloridaPhoenix.com. This episode of Welcome to Florida, as always, sponsored by Visit Sarasota. And on our Visit Sarasota bonus episode earlier in the summer, I mentioned 99 Bottles Tap Room and Bottle Shop. And boy, if you're looking for a great morning out every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, 99 Bottles Tap Room and Bottle Shop brings in authentic New York bagels from New York. And this is the real deal. These are par baked. And that means cooking the dough partially, then rapidly freezing it for storage, shipping it all the way down here to Florida. So the bagels are par baked in New York, flash frozen, shipped here that very morning, and then baked in the ovens at 99 Bottles Tap Room and Bottle Shop. Bagel sandwiches. They've got the white butcher paper, just like you'd get from the corner bodega in Manhattan. And on top of that, they've got the craft beer, wine, other food items. There's nothing else like it in Florida, nothing else like it in the Southeast. Take a vacation to New York without leaving Sarasota at 99 Bottles Tap Room and Bottle Shop. Go to visitsarasota.com to start planning your next weekend getaway or week's vacation. Now, we get to this week's guest and an unusual occurrence, Craig, because when you brought this up to me and said, hey, Rick Kilby's going to be on the podcast, I said, we already had Rick Kilby on the podcast. And you thought the same thing. We follow Rick and watch him give so many speeches that we both had assumed he'd already joined us on Welcome to Florida, but we were both wrong and he comes on today.
Yeah, well, and it's great to, you know, you mentioned about the New York bagels. Supposedly mm-hmm. the secret to making a New York bagel is the water in New York. Mm-hmm. Florida's waters were supposed to have the secret ingredient for making people feel better in the 1800s. And that mm-hmm. was a big reason for a lot of people coming here back then. Yeah. And Rick has written this beautiful book about it. I just can't say enough about how gorgeous this book is. He's a graphic designer by trade and he's taken old postcards and other printed material and put it together in a really attractive package. Plus there's a tremendous amount of history in here that is not really well known about Florida.
The book is Florida's Healing Waters, Gilded Age, Mineral Springs, Seaside Resorts, and Health Spas. I'll have a link down in the show notes for where you can find out more and purchase. RickKilby.com online at Old FLA on Twitter. Rick is a great follow for Florida devotees on Twitter. So here we go. Rick Kilby.
Rick, what you're a graphic designer by trade. What drew you to the particular topic of people coming to Florida to soak in our mineral springs and convinced that it would heal them? How did those two things hook up?
It started with my first book, and my first book originated at the Fountain of Youth Attraction in St. Augustine. And from my visit there, I saw that there was much more to roadside attractions than I originally thought. I thought they were just tourist traps. So I started blogging then, and I started going to places all over the state that I'd overlooked before. And one of the first places I went was White Springs and saw the remnants of the big spring house at White Springs in North Florida. And it's really just right off I-75. If you've been to the Folk Festival there, you can see it. And it's this big kind of concrete hulking building over this tiny little spring that has long dried up. And I think that's where my interest really got sparked. And as I started promoting my first book, Finding the Fountain of Youth, I started making pilgrimages to different sites. So I spoke in Tallahassee. So on the way back, I stopped at Hampton Springs, which is this tiny little county park in Taylor County, where they had restored what was once this giant spa, and now is this tiny little spring with this man-made pool around it and empties into a creek. And I started going to all these places all over the state that originally had these big, you know, Gilded Age hotels attached to them, but are no longer in existence, because I was fascinated, one, that they existed in the first place and could draw all these people down, and two, that they aren't there anymore at all, and very little remains and very little evidence of them being here, you know, is around. Like, you wouldn't know that this beautiful hotel at Hampton Springs was ever there unless you got off the beaten path and went to look for it.
What I really like about the book, and it's beautiful, I kind of wish we had video that we could show people just what a gorgeous book it is, but is that you have trained some attention on a topic that I think often gets overlooked, which is the role that medical tourism played in building up Florida in the 1800s.
Yeah, there was a lot of publicity about the state, you know, at the end of the, you know, after the Civil War. And there was kind of there's a wonderful book called The Florida Reader that two Rollins professors wrote. And they talk about how there's two narratives in Florida history. One is that Florida is perfect. It's paradise. You know, it's heaven on earth. And the other is it's paradise, but you can improve upon it. You know, you can make it better. And you see those two forces. So on the one side, it's saying immigrate to Florida, you know, start a farm, build a business. On the other side, it's saying come to Florida. It's God's gift and it'll make you better just by being here. You know, bathing in the water will make you better. And it's perfect the way it is. And you see these competing narratives throughout Florida history, especially after the Civil War. So it's really easy to trace if you look at popular culture, and you know, there was an explosion of print media back then. So in photography and postcards and things like that, that's where the evidence is of this age. And one of the first people that I looked at was Ralph Waldo Emerson, who came here in the 1820s, when really there wasn't a whole lot going on in Florida. Florida had just become a territory, actually, of the United States, and stayed in St. Augustine for 6 months.
What is the heyday here that we're talking about? What time period are we? Gilded Age, obviously, but that covers a lot of ground. So when is the apex of this medical tourism to take the healing waters of Florida's mineral springs occurring?
The period that I cover is really, you know, I give a lot of additional context, you know, leading up so you can understand why it exists. But it's really from the end of the Civil War to the age of the automobile. So 1870s to early turn of the century, 1905, 1910 is probably the end. Ultimately, when people could come here with their own cars, they didn't have to stay in these big Gilded Age hotels, because originally, you know, they'd be dropped off by a steamboat or come by a train and they were kind of stuck there. You know, like you're at a all-inclusive resort and you don't have a rental car, you can't go anyplace. Where when people had their own cars, they could go where they wanted. So they started going to the beach in most cases, bypassing a lot of the spas.
And like a lot of things involving Florida tourism, did this kind of start with Harriet Beecher Stowe? Was she the first one to write about this?
You know, Harriet Beecher Stowe, I like to think of as a combination, you know, the power she had. And, you know, in the 19th century, you know, President Lincoln said, "You're the little lady who started the big war." And she was kind of a cross between J.K. Rowling and Oprah. You know, she was a rock star. So she wrote Palmetto Leaves, and a lot of it was just columns she kind of cobbled together in a book. But, you know, it had a huge impact to her readers up north. And there's a professor or a professor emeritus at Florida A&M who talks about, you know, she was really tied with the Republican Party and the abolitionist movement. They were trying to get people to immigrate to Florida as a political movement so that they could kind of gain control over the Democrats and you know, give it was during Reconstruction, give all these recently freed people political power. And so, you know, there was a motive behind all her writing. And so people came down in droves when they read Palmetto Leaves, and she went to Green Cove Springs and she talked about taking the waters there. She went down to Enterprise on a steamboat, and eventually she went up the Ocklawaha River to Silver Springs, and she wrote about all her experiences like that.
Who built the hotels? This is, you know, before the age of chain hotels and Hilton and International Hotel Group. So who put all of the capital up to build these enormous accommodations?
These were mostly northern entrepreneurs who saw an opportunity. Oftentimes, you know, these beautiful wooden buildings would burn down.
Yeah.
They would be run by hoteliers who oftentimes ran hotels up north in the summer and the warmer months, and then came down to Florida in the cooler months. And that's an important aspect to talk about. It was very seasonal. It was really December through May, or even January through March for the most part. And that's why you see these photographs and everybody's wearing, you know, all these clothes, because one, it was the Victorian era and you wore lots of clothes. And two, it was winter and it was cold in North Florida for the most part. Mm-hmm. But these are people who had money, and sometimes a hotel would burn to the ground and then somebody else would come in and build a new one. There was a couple of instances where there was doctors at Magnolia Springs and Green Cove Springs who had actually been here with the Union Army to take care of, to run hospitals in North Florida, and then ran Freedmen's Bureaus up in North Florida during Reconstruction. And then they ended up building spas here later. But a lot of times it was just people looking to make a buck, because you know, they weren't
border tradition.
Exactly. It wasn't Silver Springs. It wasn't Rainbow Springs. It was really small, third magnitude, stinky sulfur springs for the most part where they built these.
Was there any medical property to this stuff at all, or was it all just bogus claims?
That's a good question. I think, well, for one thing, you know, a great example, the Fountain of Youth in St. Petersburg. You know, there was never a spring there. It was always a well. And they drilled a well, and there, you know, a hurricane would come and knock it out. So they drill a new one, and they kept moving it, you know, further and further inland. So now it's right there behind Al Lang Field. But when they looked at the quality of the water, there's high amounts of lithium in it. And, you know, they use lithium for mental patients now because it supposedly, you know, helps with mental conditions. So there are minerals in the water. And there are a lot of people who believe you absorb the minerals through your skin when you soak in it. There's people with arthritis and, you know, muscle diseases and skin diseases who still believe in taking the water. In fact, in places in Europe, it's part of your healthcare where you can go to a spa for 2 months and it, you know, the government will pay for it. You know, there haven't been any conclusive studies. I think it all believes, you know, all boils down to what you believe. But there are a lot of people who believe in the healing powers of water.
And they and they show up at Warm Mineral Springs still.
They do.
Down in Northport, yes.
They do. And, you know, Northport has the largest concentration of Ukrainians in the entire state. And they all move there in order to take the waters on a daily basis.
Wow.
And these historic tourists, did they do anything other than just go and like stand or sit in the water? And there's not roller coasters and shopping and dining, and these aren't modern amusement parks or theme parks. But what else was there to do besides, I guess, sit in the water and let it, you know, soak into your bones?
Well, these were definitely resort hotels, and these were definitely people with means, so they needed to be entertained. One of the things you would do is you would promenade. So a lot of times, you know, for instance, Green Cove Springs, we would promenade up and down the St. John's River to Magnolia Springs and back. And there was a famous path called St. David's Walk, and you would do that. And if you've ever watched the show Bridgerton, which is the 17th or 18th century, they do a lot of promenading. It's where, you know, a kind of a society thing where you're seen by others. And if you have a daughter you're trying to marry off, so you can find a prospective mate. So that was still going on. But they also did horse racing. They played croquet. They played tennis. They had, some of them had bowling alleys. And then like Green Cove Springs and White Springs, entire towns kind of developed around the spas. And so eventually you would have shopping and restaurants. I have this one postcard from Green Cove Springs. It shows a little drugstore and somebody wrote across the top, "Here's where we got our ice cream." So
exciting.
You know, they would have outings and things.
I think of promenading as being like the small town, you know, where all the high school kids cruise around the Dairy Queen on Saturday night.
Exactly. Well, when I moved to Orlando, you would promenade up and down I Drive.
So, you know, White Springs is still pretty small today, and Green Cove Springs has just been, you know, overwhelmed by Jacksonville. There's not much of a Green Cove Springs separate from Jacksonville. 100 years ago, 125 years ago, how in the world did anyone from up north find these places, which are still kind of hard to find? What were the marketing efforts? How did anyone become aware that these were even places to do this?
it was mostly print media. So there was articles and travel publications, Harper's was a really good one that would have these beautiful illustrations and woodcuts and things. Newspapers would write articles. I talk a lot about stereographs, those slides you would put in stereo view, kind of things, and it would give you kind of a 3D image. You could buy those for next to nothing, and they would sell those all over the country. And that was the thing. It was like showing your vacation slides in the, when I was a kid. You would have stacks of those in your parlor, and people would come to visit and look at all your images. And there was tons of them for Florida, and there's tons of them for Green Cove Springs and things like that. And it was also the age of the postcard. So, you had penny postcards, and people would buy the postcards and send them back up north. So it was pretty much all print media and word of mouth that got the word out. And people were readers. And that's the other thing we have to remember is that, you didn't sit around the TV in the evenings. You read, and there were a lot of written accounts, a lot of travel books, like we already talked about Harriet Beecher Stowe. There were travel guides that were very popular, and it was very exotic. Florida was kind of the Wild West of the East, and people were intrigued by it after the Civil War because it had opened it up to a whole, and the advances in transportation with steamboats and train travel made it accessible all of a sudden.
Well, and plus some of these places were much bigger than like White Springs, which basically it's got the folk festival, and that's about it.
Yeah.
Weren't there like 14 hotels there at its height?
The big one, there was one that was kind of right there at the spring house, but then around the town, there was other ones. I think the last one there was the Telfair. I think the building is still there. I mean, it's a beautiful, charming little town, and it has a lot of the buildings from that era still in existence, but it was hugely popular. So, all the leading industrialists like Edison and Rockefeller, they would come down and take the waters there. The presidents would take the waters. So Grant came down as far as Enterprise, actually, and he went to Silver Springs. Enterprise is another great example. The Enterprise really isn't even an incorporated city anymore, but it had this big hotel called the Brock House, where, Ulysses S. Grant and Harriet Beecher Stowe, all these people went and took the waters because it had such a reputation.
Craig has often explained on this show and highlighted how the state's environment is the economy, and that you cannot really separate the two. You've got a lot of people who want to tell you that the environment is a special interest, but it is, in fact, the economy. And as a state that is so reliant on tourism, if these springs were attempted to be turned into attractions today, that could not be done because a lot of these springs are gone. And we've talked on the podcast before about how White Springs is dry. How many of these historic springs that were used in this Gilded Age for healing purposes are just gone now due to water use and human consumption and lack of conservation?
White Springs is probably the best example. There was also one in Polk County called Kissingen Springs, and both those were victims of the phosphate mining industry. They diverted the flow of the water. Kissingen Springs really never had a spa, but they wanted to make it a spa. That's why it was originally called Ponce de Leon or Ponce Springs, and they renamed it Kissingen Springs because there's a famous spa town in Germany called Bad Kissingen, I think. And so that was the intention, but it was always a recreational place. And that's where they had picnics and all the political rallies. And they had a casino where people gathered, not a gambling casino, but it's for the most part, just a mud puddle now. I'd say there's a handful, but I think all the springs are impaired to some degree. The flow is diminished so much, and we've added so much nitrogen and phosphorus to the aquifer that, they're all gunky, nasty looking algae filled pools for the most part. The ones that still have significant flow are decent, but none of them look like the way they did when I was a kid.
One of the things that surprised me from reading your book was how many of these springs bottled their water and sold it for people to drink too, which I don't think the FDA would let you do that now.
No. And that's one of the things that ended it, because there were so many people out there selling waters that had reputed medical powers that really didn't. So most of the hotels bottled them. Green Cove Springs bottled the water there. Hampton Springs bottled the water there, and they would ship them up north. Sometimes they sold them in pharmacies and places like that. But there are other ones that really just drilled wells and they would sell it at spring water. And, basically it's from the same aquifer. So who knows? Orange City Water in Volusia was one that was really popular. And supposedly John D. Rockefeller, who had a place in Ormond Beach, loved Orange City mineral water so much that he took it with him wherever he went and would drink it and bathe in it, supposedly. And eventually that, you know, the well was there until the 1980s. And I think the city of Orange City bought the well and capped it. So, but there were places like that all over. You know, Tampa is a great example. There was all sorts of springs and wells all over. And my one of my favorite stories is Eulalie, where it was Magby, something like Magby Springs originally, and they rebranded it. And they took that, the water treatment facility or the water plant that's right there and redid it. And they actually looked into the blueprints and they found that one of the pipes coming out originally originated in a spring. So they repiped it back into Magby Springs so that they found a whole nother spring under the building they didn't know existed when they redid that spring. And so the springs can be restored, I think is what we learned from that. And if we do the right thing. Last time I was there, it was still had a bunch of algae and stuff, and which is understandable considering where it is.
Yeah, that's true. Quite a few of these springs now are part of the state park system too, right? Like De Leon Springs. Talk a little bit about that.
There's two Ponce de Leon Springs. There's one, I think, in Holmes County in the Panhandle, and there's one in Volusia County, which is one of my favorite places because of the, it's the old Spanish mill. The
restaurant, yes.
Yeah, where you make your pancakes. And I love that place. But it, what people, I don't think, realize is how much history is on that site. They pulled canoes out there that are thousands of years old. One, you know, I take these dates with a grain of salt. One was reportedly 8,000 years old and was supposedly the oldest canoe ever found anywhere, which I'm not sure is true. And then they found another one that was slightly newer. It was like 6,000 years old, but there was...
It was older than Disney anyway.
It was older than Disney. And, you know, most of these places had an indigenous presence long before people from European descent ever got here. We know because there are shell mounds around them. And a great example is De Leon Springs. You know, there's a little house right there and you can see it's on a hill, but it's not a hill. It's actually an old shellman. Then there was a British brand land grant and people lived there. And eventually there was a planter who had a plantation with enslaved labor and built a mill there and, you know, pulled up the water, used the force of the spring water coming out to spin the mill wheel, which is, you know, the Spanish never really had a mill there, even though it's called the old Spanish mill. Eventually it became a place for taking the waters. And then it became a tourist place and then it became a tourist attraction so that they had a water skiing elephant and a ski show like Cypress Gardens. It had a monkey island like Silver Springs. I don't know that the monkeys ever escaped there, but I'm not sure why. And then it became a state park. So, you know, all the little boxes in Florida history, that place checks, you know, because
well, the water skiing elephant was an important box to check.
It was very important. My favorite story about that is I met the lady who owned the water skiing elephant and they would come down from Vermont in the summers and she would water ski with that, you know, it was basically a pontoon boat that the elephant stood on and they would take it all around the spring run. And her name
was
Liz.
Don't give away the secret.
I was imagining slaloming. No, you blew it up for me.
I don't think elephants could do that with their legs. I think their girth is too big. So they would spin it around. But when she went to college, they had to get rid of the elephant. So 40 years pass. And she wants to reconnect with her elephant and she finds out it's in Valdosta, Georgia, and she's still coming down to Florida every year. So she stops in Valdosta at there's this wildlife refuge and they tell her, be careful because this elephant can be aggressive. So she goes up to the elephant and 40 years after she last saw it, the elephant still remembered her.
Wow.
And so she would go and visit the elephant every year until it died.
No more skiing, though, huh?
No more skiing.
Oh, well. No more skiing. But tell people, just in case they're not familiar, tell people a little bit about the restaurant there and why it's so special.
I actually love the place. There's no AC, so go when it's cool. It's my recommendation. But each table has a griddle in the middle, and they grind their own flour and bring you pancake batter, and you pour your own pancakes, and you can put stuff in it. They'll bring you bananas and chocolate chips and blueberries.
Yeah. What is the name of this place again?
The Old Spanish Mill.
Chad's writing it down right now.
Oh, my God. Yeah, writing it down. Yeah, I'm texting it to myself and going this weekend. It's sort of like the melting pot, but for pancakes. I love it.
Yeah, but go when it's cooler and go in off, go during the week, because sometimes the wait could be 3 hours just to get in there. It's an incredible place, and I love it. But there is a group of from Stetson who did some research there about all the enslaved people, and I think that's an important part of the story that isn't well interpreted there. They found the names of 200 individuals who were enslaved there, and that kind of gets shoved aside, and it's very important. And so they actually are training incarcerated people to be historians. Oh, wow. And they track down their names and read their names, and they're trying to get more of a permanent presence for that side of the story.
Oh, wow. That may be a future podcast.
Yeah. Andy Eisen is his name. He's at Stetson. Okay. He leads that project. And at the Enterprise Museum, they had an exhibit about that. And it's very powerful because after emancipation, a lot of the enslaved people moved down near Enterprise and had their own community with their own train stop, and they grew citrus.
Wow. Huh. The heyday is sort of before the advent of the automobile.
Yeah.
What the automobile shows up, what happens? Do they all decline at once, or was it a little bit at a time?
Well, I think it kind of, taking the waters at springs kind of fell out of favor. Sea bathing became popular before people really swam recreationally. And once they started to exercise in the water and swim more, they stopped sea bathing, and going to the beach just became popular. And for a long time, I go into this whole movement of sanitariums that were built where people had the water cure, which could be done in bathtubs. And, treatments like soaking yourself in wet sheets and needle showers, they started to have facilities like that. But it's like kind of society kind of just moved on. And so that the springs that were still in existence that were kind of major springs kind of became recreational resources more than anything else. So what I say now is, if you want to take the waters the way they would have done in the 19th century, there's three places to go. Green Cove Springs, that has a recreational pool that's open in the warm months. Safety Harbor, where they still have a spa. In Warm Mineral Springs, which to me, Warm Mineral Springs is the closest thing to the European tradition. And you will hear Russian and all these other Eastern German, European languages being spoken there. People aren't going there to do laps. They're doing there to just soak in the water all day long. Safety Harbor has, a complete spa where they'll wrap you in seaweed and put hot rocks on your back and all that kind of silly stuff.
And lighten your wallet pretty severely.
Yeah, but it's... It's still the spring water that, you can go into the salon there, and there's like this little plexiglass window where you see these PVC pipes coming out of the ground, and that's where they get the spring water.
Wow.
go ahead, Craig.
I was just going to say, so what changed? I mean, was it just that suddenly people said, oh, no, springs aren't where it's at. The beach is where it's at. We go sit in the Atlantic now, or sit in the Gulf now.
I think societal changes is part of it, but I also think we put more stock in modern medicine. And so we started, that became kind of like folk medicine. So, it was the same age when people started taking the waters, it was that era of heroic medicine where, you could be bled, or they could put leeches on you, or they could give you stuff that would, purge you and, make you go to the bathroom or vomit and things like that. Or you could take the waters, which is a much better alternative, I think, those treatments. But, in the 20th century, we started to have modern cures, and the Food and Drug Administration started saying, you can't sell snake oil. There's one story I ran across where the FDA or one of the government organizations made the bottler at Safety Harbor stop bottling the water there because they didn't believe the claims they were making were true. And so, that's, they believed that the water would cure just about anything. Consumptives were the main people who started coming here: rheumatism, emphysema, liver disorders, kidney disorders, female troubles, you name it. But anything that ailed you could be cured by the water.
Where does that notion come from? And does it go all the way back to the search for the fountain of youth and, biblical, thinking about, there's almost like the lost city of gold somewhere. There's this spring where we'll all, turn young and become 19 again.
Yeah, it does. It really does. I think all cultures that develop have, I think they originally believe water is sacred. And I do believe, on a metaphysical level, water is sacred to some extent. Water is life. We can't live without it. And we emerge from water. We're born from water. And I think, going far enough, there is that belief. And then eventually the spirituality of the water evolves to, there's gods and goddesses. Like, in ancient Greece, they built temples around the springs because, the goddess like Poseidon or something resides
there.
Water
nymphs and so
forth. Yeah, and you can go there if you have an ailment and go there and be cured by these gods and goddesses. And then the Romans come along and they're way into bathing. So throughout their empire, they start building these huge bath complexes. The, you know, the one I visited was Bath, England, which started as Roman Bath, the Roman Baths, and then was rediscovered by the Edwardians and the Victorians, and they started bathing there. And then eventually, when people started going back, you know, taking the grand tour and going back to continental Europe, they rediscovered these Roman baths, and this whole culture of bathing comes back and into vogue. And so it's very fashionable to go hang out at spas. So, you know, these places like Perrier and Evian that we know for the bottled water started out as spas where people went in order to hang out at these luxury hotels, and still are today for the most part. Anything with Baden in Germany is a spa town.
So this is going to sound like a flippant question, but it's not, which is, how did they endure the smell? Because a lot, you know, sulfur springs do not smell good.
I know, it's so weird too, because the ones that they seem to look for, you know, that were drawn to in Florida were the stinkiest, smelliest ones. A great example, well, Green Cove Springs still reeks of sulfur, and it's just so strong and overpowering. It's probably the one in the state that has the strongest smell. But Green Springs in Volusia County is this tiny little one in Enterprise. You know, it's opaque. The water isn't clear. It looks emerald on some days, and it looks more topaz on other days, depending on the light conditions. But they thought that was perfect. And, you know, they wanted ones where you could detect a presence of minerals, because minerals is what supposedly caused the healing. They didn't want crystal clear waters of Silver Springs. You know, they wanted the third magnitude little mucky hole in the ground. And, you know, the other thing is, like, at Warm Mineral Springs, there's all these great pictures of people packing the mud on their skins, because supposedly the minerals in the mud would help you heal too.
We've done a number of episodes on Florida's springs and the health or lack thereof of the springs, and folks can go back through the archives and listen to those. But for all the people you're bringing new to the podcast today, Rick, just to explain to them, what are the big threats to the springs, and why do they look nothing like they did then, let alone, you know, from your childhood, as you mentioned?
Well, my first book is called Finding the Fountain of Youth, and I really talk about the way the myth of the Fountain of Youth was kind of used as a marketing hook to bring people to Florida, where you could kind of reboot your life. And I always say it worked too well, you know, that people, so many people have come here to start their life over, that, you know, there are too many straws going down into the aquifer, making too many withdrawals. So there's the issue of, we're sucking too much water out of the aquifer. And the Florida aquifer is, you know, 80 to 90% of our drinking water, and it extends, you know, from the Carolinas down to South Florida. And there's too many people taking too much water. And then all these people who moved here wanted to have a perfect lawn, and they're putting all this crap on their lawn that ends up going down in the aquifer and coming up in our springs, which, you know, is nitrogen and phosphorus, which creates algae blooms, which kills the native growth there and just makes it a gunky mess. You know, springs can be restored, but I don't know that they'll ever be restored to the way they were. Mm-hmm. The stories you hear about the power that they had when you know, these accounts were written, where the spring boil, you know, would be significantly off the surface of the water, you know, and you could hear the boil, you know, from the distance, because the force of the water coming up from the aquifer, that doesn't exist anymore, sadly. Yeah,
where it would actually throw boats up in the air a little ways.
Right. Yeah.
You're literally talking about the water bubbling, gurgling, boiling out of the spring and breaking the surface tension of the water. Yeah, it's a, you know, imagine.
That doesn't happen anymore. That doesn't happen anymore.
When before the state took over Silver Springs, they had like Silver River State Park, and I took a canoe up the Silver River, you know, to the main basin there. And, you know, I remember as a kid going in, you know, it was crystal clear and you could see the sandy bottom and the healthy eelgrass. But I did a giant canoe all by myself all the way up the river. And, the, you know, there was no problem at all with the force of the water trying to push me back. And then I really couldn't find the boil, you know, because there was no significant indentation on the surface indicating where the boil was, which, you know, at one time, Silver Springs by flow was the largest artesian spring in the world because of the volume of the water. I think, and I, you know, there, I don't know if there's evidence of this, I think all those people moving down to the villages are just sucking all the water away from that. And I, you know, according to Dr. Knight, who at this Howard Odom's Springs what group, whatever institute. Yeah. The on land in terms of flow, the largest spring is now Rainbow Springs. So the hydrology has actually shifted from Silver Springs to Rainbow Springs. In terms of just pure volume, there's one near St. Mark's that bubbles up in the middle of a creek that has more water, but it's in the water. But the, on land, Rainbow Springs has surpassed Silver Springs.
Well, you know, the villages, they got to keep those golf courses green, man. That's that's what's drawing the people in.
And they keep building more, and it kills me. Yeah, I'm not optimistic for the future of the Springs, which is why I really wanted to focus on history on this latest book, because a lot of the talks I did were environmental for environmental groups, and it got so depressing because the awareness increased, but so little got done to take care of the root causes of what's making our springs bad. So they'll throw some money at it. And so, you know, they'll say, oh, we're going to get rid of these septic tanks, or we're going to, you know, make the sidewalk better at this spring. But until you, you know, stop the pollution at its source, nothing's going to change.
Rick Kilby has been our guest. The book is Florida's Healing Waters, Gilded Age Mineral Springs, Seaside Resorts, and Health Spas. Thanks as always, Rick, and we will keep in touch. Okay.
Thank you. Loved it.
Thanks.
Keep doing what you're doing, you guys.
All right. Now go soak in something.
All right, I will. See ya.
See ya.
Yeah, it was kind of a sobering note to end on there with Rick. And, you know, unfortunately with the springs, to an extent, you can address their health one by one, but it's not like a forest or a meadow. You know, they're so deeply connected underground. You're talking about really regional landscape and almost statewide level solutions that have to be approached, and obviously we know how difficult that is in Florida.
Sure. Well, and even with the individuals, Rick mentioned Kissingen Springs. Back in 2010, I did a big series for the Times about Florida Springs, and I talked to a guy from the water management district in that area who had done a study on what would it take to bring back the flow of water in Kissingen Springs. Mm-hmm. Because as Rick mentioned, in the 1940s, a phosphate mine had sucked away an awful lot of the flow, and so it had turned into a big mud hole. And the guy who had done the report said, well, the phosphate company is not sucking that much water out of it anymore. They've cut back on their water use. They've been required to cut back on their water use. But now there's been so much residential development in the area, You'd have to cut the residential use of water by 40% to even start seeing any flow in Kissingen Springs.
Yeah. And that only goes up every single year as more and more people come here. I mean, that genie is
almost 12 years ago.
Yeah.
That was 12 years ago. So who knows what it's like now?
Well, this is the Water Management District episode of Welcome to Florida. So we will end the way we started.
Well, I just wanted to point out one thing, which is, you know, we thought the springs would heal us, but it turns out we need to heal the springs.
Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.